I will, however, I was really depressed after this election. One of the ways that I helped to cheer myself up was by making Ralph Nader jokes. Now, again, I don't want people to take what I'm, the Naderites in attendance here, to take what I'm saying personally. Let me once again see your hands. I want to make sure you all understand this is not to be taken personally, okay? Understand? Green light, Naderites? Good. How many Naderites does it take to screw in a light bulb? How many? Just one. He or she holds the light bulb in place while the world revolves around them. What do you call 10,000 Naderites at a campaign rally? Republicans. And where's the safest place to hide something from a Naderite? Under a book. None of those are to be, just as I don't want you to take those things personally, none of those are to be mistaken for terms of endearment. One should understand that I felt pretty bitter about this past election, in case that hasn't become perfectly clear at this point. The fact of the matter is, I think that Ralph Nader, in addition to performing an absolutely essential function for the Republicans, utterly defiled his own social legacy. For a man of Nader's obvious intelligence to fail to grasp how important not only the Supreme Court, but the actions of the federal judiciary were to the causes that he espoused, and to neglect the consequences for generations to come of failing to gain control of the White House so that that federal judiciary could be selected. I think that Nader himself can be faulted in terms that could not be exaggerated. I think he betrayed his entire life's work, and I think he betrayed all of us. I think he performed an essential function for the Bush campaign, for the Bush machine, by pinning Al Gore down on his left flank. Basically, Gore was under attack from the left by Nader, even as George Bush attacked him from the right. One of the things that I have distilled from the better part of a quarter of a century of intense political research, and most of that now on the air, if there's a fundamental truth, perhaps a social truth, certainly a political truth, it's that all evil really lies, really stems from lying. I've been strongly affected by Buddhist thinking. I don't call myself a Buddhist, and I don't belong to any sect or practice any sort of ritual, but yet the teachings of the Dhammapada, one of the core texts of Buddhist doctrine, I think are the most eloquent and substantive and also concise compilation of spiritual and ethical rules to live by that I have seen. There's a passage in the Dhammapada that says, "When your words are lies, where will your mischief end?" And I think that's a very important thing to contemplate. And Ralph Nader's entire candidacy was founded upon two fundamental and brazen, bald-faced lies. First of all, that there's no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. There are profound differences between the Democrats and the Republicans, not perhaps as dramatic as some people would like, but then there are people who perhaps would like to live forever. And sometimes, all the time, we can't always have what we want. Fact of the matter is, there are profound differences between the Democrats and the Republicans, and one would think that the appointments that George Bush has made would have dramatized that rather clearly. People like John Ashcroft, and we're going to get to the death of Mel Carnahan during the course of the talk this evening, people like John Ashcroft, people like Gail Norton, Theodore Olson is now going to be Solicitor General. When one takes a look at the manipulation of the petroleum market, one should consider who is now in power. Well, you've got George Bush, who is an oil man, Dick Cheney, who is an executive with the largest petroleum drilling company. The Secretary of Commerce is Don Evans, who is an oil man. Spencer Abraham is the Secretary of Energy. He is a former Republican senator from Michigan, whose main political gambit was trying to reduce the pollution controls on the automobile industry. You've got Paul O'Neill is the head of Treasury. Andrew Card is the White House chief of staff, a former lobbyist for the automobile industry. So this should give people a pretty good view on who is now in power. But the fact of the matter is, you've got Gail Norton, called James Watt in a skirt, as the Secretary of the Interior. These are some very, very, very dramatic departures from what Al Gore would have put in office. If one knew nothing else about the two parties, a study of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, quite literally a Nazi branch of the Republican Party with its roots firmly planted in the Third Reich and the Axis powers of World War II, something that the Bush political machine has been inextricably linked with, that alone should illustrate to people the dramatic differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. There is no Nazi branch of the Democratic Party. The Democrats have not assassinated Republican politicians, but in fact, both Kennedys and a great many other people have been assassinated. The Democrats don't stage coups d'etat in the United States. The Republicans have staged several. So the very premise of the Nader candidacy was a fundamental lie. Just take a look at what George Bush has done with the various executive orders that were issued by Bill Clinton with regard to safety in the workplace, with regard to the ability of labor unions to affect the political process, with regard to the right of women to abort. All of a sudden, social organizations that were operating overseas and political organizations that had championed a woman's right to choose were suddenly taken off of the federal, basically they were curtailed from federal funding. And that was one of the very first things George Bush did when he came into office. So the premise of the Nader candidacy, which is that there was no difference between the Democrats and Republicans, is a brazen and extremely destructive lie. And again, I'm sorry if Naderites don't, if they take that personally. That's something that when you make a mistake, it's important to learn from it. And I think if the people who supported Ralph Nader have not figured out that they've made a mistake, well, stay tuned, because I think the dimension of the mistake that you've made and the enormous price that not only you but the rest of the human race is going to be paying for a very, very long time is going to be made absolutely, unequivocally, and excruciatingly clear. And I think you can count on that. Then another, even more brazen lie was executed by Ralph Nader, who premised his candidacy upon not running in states where the outcome was considered to be in doubt. Well, in fact, he did just exactly that. He engaged in a last-minute blitzkrieg of states where the outcome was very much in doubt, and although Al Gore wound up winning those states, he was forced to divert very crucial campaign resources to winning those states. So the premise of Ralph Nader's candidacy was basically a twofold lie. One, that there was no difference between the Democrats and the Republicans, which is politically illiterate. And two, that he would not campaign in states where the outcome is close, and he did just exactly that. And again, as the Dhammapada says, when your words are lies, where will your mischief end? I think if Ralph Nader had become president, which of course he wasn't going to do, I think that the cult of personality that he would have engendered, I think the slavishness, excuse me for spritzing, but what the heck, the slavishness with which his followers pursued him. I think the United States under Ralph Nader would be very much like Romania under Mr. Ceausescu, the communist dictator there. It would be a huge cult of personality. There'd be little busts of Ralph Nader available. And when people went home from their jobs at the Naderwerke, they could go and they could drink their foaming Nader brow and tell all sorts of lies. Oh, I remember when he came to our village. It would be really quite terrible and would not work. And that's basically what I think, if Nader had ever been elected, that's what he would be like. The fact of the matter is that the Nader candidacy was a lie in many other ways as well. How many of you were aware that Ralph Nader isn't even a member of the Green Party? Ralph Nader is not a member of the Green Party. And beyond that, and more than one step beyond that, Al Gore had stated in no uncertain terms that if the McCain-Feingold bill passed, that he would sign it into law. Well, the McCain-Feingold bill would have given the Green Party more funds than they would have gotten had Ralph Nader gotten his blessed 5%, which was the stated rationale for him running in the first place, was that, well, if we get 5% of the popular vote, we'll get some funding for the Green Party in the next election. Well, if Al Gore had been elected president and had signed the McCain-Feingold bill into law, that would have given the Green Party even more. Beyond that, Ralph Nader himself is a consummate hypocrite. First place, Winona LaDuke, his vice presidential candidate, criticized Al Gore because his mother, not Al Gore, but his mother, held a nice big block of Occidental Petroleum stock in the trust that she inherited when her husband, not incidentally a former United States senator from Tennessee who was voted out of office because of his support for civil rights and his opposition to the Vietnam War, when her husband died, she inherited a block of Occidental Petroleum stock, and Al Gore was basically held to account. Well, the Naderites doubted Al Gore's populist sincerity or the sincerity of his populist sentiments because of this big block of Occidental Petroleum stock that not Gore, but his mother held in the family trust that she inherited when her husband died. Well, if one examines Ralph Nader's investment portfolio, and I would point out that Ralph Nader is a multimillionaire, one of Ralph Nader's many lucrative holdings is through the Fidelity Magellan Fund, through which he has invested in just about every corporation he criticized others for having been involved with, including Occidental Petroleum, and also Halliburton Oil, Exxon, Chevron, and a whole bunch of other environmentally destructive and politically destructive corporations, which Ralph Nader had inveighed about in no uncertain terms. And yet Ralph, St. Ralph, the man on the white horse, was invested in these very corporations, but yet the media did not hold Nader to the same standard that the Naderites were holding Al Gore. That was one of the many areas where I think the media were deficient, and Nader himself is a consummate hypocrite in other ways as well. He is, as I said, a multimillionaire, yet he would not allow the employees in his nonprofits to unionize. He utilized his very strong connections with the Trial Lawyers Association to harass them when they attempted to do that. And in turn, he fired a fellow named Michael Chirac from a publication called the Multinational Monitor when Michael Chirac attempted to lay bare the close cooperation between multinational corporate policy and policies of the Central Intelligence Agency. One wonders why Ralph Nader wasn't interested in pursuing that. Ralph Nader also had endorsed many things that were bad for consumers and or labor, including airline deregulation and also no-fault automobile insurance, which would have enabled you all to pay lower automobile insurance rates when you drove here. Okay, Ralph Nader's main constituency was the Trial Lawyers Association, who now, thank God, are beginning to abandon Ralph Nader. But again, I think that Ralph Nader's candidacy was an absolutely essential element of a pincers movement, literally a military operation against, or a military style operation against Al Gore. And it pinned him down on his left flank. And if this seems unfair to some people, answer this question. Why did the Republicans buy Nader ads in two key swing states during the campaign as they are unequivocally documented as having done? Why were the Republicans buying ads for Nader? Well, again, I don't think you need to be Sherlock Holmes or Lieutenant Columbo to figure that out. They were buying ads for Nader because that was good for Bush. Checking that's the time on the tape. Let's see, would people like to take a break at this point, or shall I continue? Because we're not quite halfway through. How many are for continuing without a break?
Yeah, let's continue,
Dave. All right, well, we're going to continue, but it's a question of whether to continue without a break. How many want to take a break? Well, I think we're going to continue. So those of you, if people would like maybe to take a... How many... Here we go. Now we're going to get really Republican about this. How many of you that want to take the break have to go to the bathroom? See? Just think I'm John Ashcroft for the time being, and I want to know how many of you need to go wee-wee. All righty. Well, if you'd like to do that, why don't I put the tape on pause here while you answer some absolutely imperative natural functions so that you can give me your undivided attention when you come back, and then we will continue. So a brief bathroom break and then more of this forced march. And then, but it's only going to be brief, 5 minutes, and then back to the war. My Secret Service contingent. All righty. Again, in analyzing the electoral coup of the year 2000 as a military paradigm, I think that another element that pinned Al Gore down, and which also in many ways had its roots in the Reagan and Bush administrations, which also to a certain extent, to a large extent, came to power as a result of the manipulation of petroleum prices and that is the Wenho Lee case. Now, again, the Energy Department, as well as the Clinton administration, and by extension Al Gore, were denigrated by the notion that Wenho Lee had betrayed nuclear secrets to Red China. Well, first of all, Wenho Lee was a native of Taiwan, and the Kuomintang is not generally known. That was Chiang Kai-shek's fascist political organization, and it was, to a considerable extent, still is fascist. The Kuomintang and the Taiwanese are not known for their political love for the communist Chinese. So the notion that a Taiwanese-born nuclear scientist would be betraying America's nuclear secrets was at its fundamental level not only fallacious, and we'll get into the actual facts concerning the Wenho Lee case, but it was also deeply racist. It was a grouping of all Chinese Americans and all Asians in general into a single category. It was a precipitation of the political myth of the yellow peril, so to speak. It was a truly crude maneuver, and yet I think to a certain extent a very successful maneuver by the Republicans. And the way that this pinned Al Gore down was really several-fold. And again, conceiving of this as a military paradigm, as the execution of a military operation. And again, I'm just going to interrupt ever so briefly here. If I could get some of our KFJC people or a KFJC person to secure some more copies of Other Means, because those went very, very quickly. Though some of those are back in a closet. I don't know if Steve's still around, but if not, you know, so that's just for the break point. Wenho Lee, again, a nuclear scientist at Los Alamos, born in Taiwan, and yet fingered by the media and by the Republican Party, who issued a report by Representative Christopher Cox of Newport Beach, one of the great bastions of political liberalism in Southern California. Representative Cox produced a report which blamed the compromising of America's nuclear security on lax security procedures by not only the Clinton administration, but by the Clinton administration Energy Department, which, bear in mind, had been in charge, was being run by Bill Richardson, a Mexican-American who was being discussed as a potential vice presidential candidate, and also the Energy Department that had been charged by Bill Clinton with trying to hold down the rising price of crude during the 2000 campaign. And it was the rising price of crude which helped to destabilize the American economy and helped to put anxiety into the pit of the stomachs of the American voters, and also, in all likelihood, helped to affect the electoral coup of the year 2000 to a certain extent. So the Wenho Lee case discredited Bill Richardson, destroyed his potential vice presidential candidacy. It hamstrung the Clinton Energy Department and its abilities to hold down the price of oil. It played the racist card in a very real way, where the average white American was being manipulated by the notion of the yellow peril. All them Chinese and Vietnamese and all them other people coming over here going to do all that nasty stuff, take all of our nuclear secrets, give them all to the Chinese, and they're all the same. They got funny little eyes, and they're all going to do that stuff. Now, I mean, just that's basically how that one played out in the hinterland, because the fact of the matter is that Wenho Lee was not only Taiwanese, he was not a spy for the communist Chinese. In fact, as it turned out, he had been operating on behalf of, to a considerable extent, the Central Intelligence Agency. And when the betrayal of the W-88 nuclear warhead took place, Bill Clinton was governor of Arkansas. He was not president of the United States. The available evidence suggests, and a very good job was done by this, on this by Robert Paree of the consortium, that one of the quid pro quos that was affected during the Iran-Contra scandal, and bear in mind that it was George I who ran the Iran-Contra scandal, utilizing the intergovernmental agency networks that were put together as part of the recommendations coming out of the Vice Presidential Task Force on Combating Terrorism. One of the elements of the Iran-Contra scandal involved the procuring of shoulder-fired SA-7 anti-aircraft missiles from the People's Republic of China. Basically, after the Bolton Amendment was passed, the Contras were in need of shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles in order to counteract Soviet-made attack helicopters, which were proving very effective in the field. Well, the U.S. was not in a position to supply these, so what took place was basically a quid pro quo whereby the Chinese procured a shipment of SA-7 missiles, again, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles, to neutralize the Soviet-made attack helicopters that the Sandinistas were using. And in exchange, the Chinese were given access to certain American national security secrets. This was seen by the Chinese government as not only stealing a march on the Soviet Union, that was a bitter rival of the Chinese, even though both were communist powers, it was also seen as a way of improving relations with the United States. The available evidence suggests very strongly that Wen Ho Lee not only was not the person who betrayed the W-88 warhead to the communist Chinese. Certainly, if that took place, you couldn't pin it on Bill Clinton because it took place in the 1980s and he wasn't president then. But the W-88 gambit, so to speak, was almost certainly a quid pro quo run by George Bush in order to obtain the SA-7 shoulder-fired missiles for the communist, Contras in Nicaragua from the communist Chinese. A Reagan-appointed judge faulted Bill Clinton Justice Department under Janet Reno for pursuing the Wen Ho Lee case, yet it was really the Republicans who were flogging the horse forward the entire time. So we have this very remarkable state of affairs during the 2000 electoral coup. We have a Taiwanese-born nuclear scientist operating on behalf of the CIA, being accused of betraying the Energy Department and America's nuclear secrets, and this somehow was the fault of the Clinton administration for betraying these secrets, yet it took place in the 1980s, and it was the fault of the U.S. Department of Justice for prosecuting Wen Ho Lee for this alleged betrayal. See, it was a catch-22. Either he betrayed the secrets, or the Justice Department was at fault. Well, in fact, it worked very effectively in both ways. He could not have been operating on behalf of the Clinton administration. He certainly was almost certainly was operating on behalf of the Bush, really Reagan administration, but run by George Bush, and there is no evidence whatsoever that he betrayed the W-88 warhead. He did, in fact, establish high-level contacts with some of his Chinese counterparts, Chinese nuclear scientists, but these contacts were not in any way definitively linked to the betrayal of the W-88 warhead. He was operating, as was his wife, on behalf of the CIA, and almost certainly doing so on behalf of the Bush administration. In fact, in 1986, a Reagan administration aide named Roger Heffron basically expressed fear for his life and said that the Reagan and Bush administrations, directed by George Bush, who was, according to Roger Heffron, was running the White House, and Ronald Reagan was basically a figurehead. Roger Heffron charged that basically George Bush was deliberately betraying nuclear technology to China in order to precipitate a nuclear war between the Chinese and the Soviets by trying to goad the Soviets into conducting a preemptive nuclear strike on the Chinese. So there was evidence as early as 1986 from a Reagan White House staffer that George I, the elder George Bush, was engaged in some form of transference of nuclear technology to the People's Republic of China. I think Robert Peree has made a very, very good case that, in fact, the contacts between the CIA-directed Wen Ho Lee and the Chinese communist nuclear scientists was as part of the quid pro quo to establish the SA-7 missiles for the Contras to use against the Sandinistas. However, during the course of the campaign, in addition to hamstringing the Clinton Energy Department so that it could not effectively regulate petroleum prices, in addition to discrediting the Clinton Justice Department, it also, I think, worked very effectively as a tool of psychological warfare with regard to the Buddhist temple gambit. Now, there was a fundraiser that took place in a Buddhist temple in 1996. Al Gore was excoriated for this. Dick Cheney, by the way, held several of the identical type of fundraiser when he was Secretary of Defense in 1992. The press did not pursue that. But the fact of the matter is that in the American popular political imagination, certainly the Republicans went out of their way to portray this, there appears to have been a certain amount of what psychologists refer to as stimulus generalization, generalizing from the Asian Buddhist priests at this Buddhist temple, in whose presence Al Gore was videoed, and generalizing to the Wen-Ho Lee case, where, again, the yellow peril, you know, them Asians betraying our nuclear secrets to the Chinese. I think a very effective, albeit perhaps in some people's minds unconscious, association was created between the two. The Clinton administration was caving into the yellow peril. Al Gore was part of it. You know, he was shown hanging out with these Buddhists. Wen-Ho Lee was betraying our nuclear warheads. The message to the American hinterland was that Clinton is basically in bed with the gooks. Forgive my use of a strong racial term, but that was the message that the Republicans meant to communicate in a very, very direct fashion by linking the Wen-Ho Lee case, fallacious in the ways that I've already discussed, with the Buddhist temple fundraiser. So this, again, was a gambit that had its roots in the administration, really, of George I, George Herbert Walker Bush, and his legacy of covert operations, but which carried forward and was used to tar the Clinton Energy Department to block its effective regulation, suppression of petroleum prices, and the Clinton Justice Department, and it was used to tar Al Gore by associating the Wen-Ho Lee case with the Buddhist temple fundraiser. Now, in discussing the death of John F. Kennedy Jr., I'm going to chew this cough drop here so that I don't wind up inhaling it. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take this time to switch cassettes while I'm chewing the cough drop so that we can kill. Anyway, now that the cough has dropped, so to speak, something else had dropped was the aircraft carrying former Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan, who was running for senator against a charming individual named John Ashcroft, currently holding forth as Attorney General of the United States, an individual who wrote for a magazine called The Southern Partisan and who is known to have espoused the view that the Southern Partisan, which was a blatantly racist, actually sort of an equal opportunity destroyer. They tar everybody from African Americans to gays to feminists to Eastern Europeans to Jews to just about anybody who isn't a Scotch-Irish Southern redneck. And John Ashcroft wrote for the Southern Partisan and said that this magazine had performed an invaluable service by helping to dispel the notion that people like Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, and Confederate President Jefferson Davis had risked their lives and their sacred fortunes for some perverted agenda, i.e. slavery, which was, if nothing else, somewhat original, at least for a major American politician to come right out and say that. John Ashcroft, one of the most right-wing senators in the United States Senate, was being challenged and was being viewed as very vulnerable by a challenge by Mel Carnahan, the Democratic governor of Missouri who was running for United States Senator. Now, in October, there was a very key period of time where Mel Carnahan was running a very close race with John Ashcroft. Ashcroft was seen as being vulnerable. The state of Missouri was seen as being accessible to, first of all, a takeaway of a Republican seat held by Ashcroft by Mel Carnahan. Even more importantly, the state was seen as a potentially vulnerable swing state. It could go either way. So that Missouri was being seen as, first of all, one of the states. I also forgot the fact that the governor's race was seen as being very much up in the air. Missouri was seen as being key to, first of all, the presidential contest. It was a swing state. It was seen as being one of the areas where the Democrats could gain a Senate seat. It also was an area where the a state in which the gubernatorial race was seen as being wide open. Also, Al Gore and George Bush were going to square off in one of the many debates. Not one of the many debates. One of the debates that they were going to have. All of a sudden, Mel Carnahan's plane went down, and he was killed in the crash of a private plane along with his son. Initial press reports said, just like the JFK crash, that, well, the weather had been terrible. They thought the plane had been struck by lightning. And yet, it turned out that the weather wasn't that bad. Other planes were able to fly very effectively, and that there's no particular indication that the plane was struck by lightning. The wreckage was described by one investigator as being scattered all, the tiny pieces of wreckage were found as being scattered all over a wide area. Well, when a private plane crashes, you don't get large, small pieces of wreckage scattered over a large area. That will happen if the plane explodes in midair for one reason or another. If you've seen footage of a small plane that's crashed, it may have, unless it's crashed along a cliff and rolled downhill or crashed on a mountainside, the wreckage isn't broken up into tiny pieces and scattered all over a wide area. I suspect that Mel Carnahan's plane was bombed or otherwise blown up. It wouldn't necessarily have to be a bomb. Whether or not the plane was bombed, this affected not the Senate race, because ultimately Mel Carnahan's widow did win the Senate seat, but Missouri did become a swing state that went for George Bush. I am not sure off the top of my head, but I believe the Republican actually won the gubernatorial race as well. But the death of Mel Carnahan forced a postponing of the debate. It was seen by many analysts at the time as diminishing the turnout by the Democrats, who were seen as being very enthusiastic for the Democratic governor and who were not seen as being lured to the polls nearly as readily by Carnahan's widow. And it may very well be that Carnahan was murdered and that his murder had much to do with Missouri going into the Bush camp. Certainly that is my analysis. And I think the extreme venality of John Ashcroft, an individual who has gone to bat on behalf of a Dr. Sell, who was a white supremacist-oriented dentist who was convicted of defrauding Medicaid, or Medicare, rather. He then was indicted for plotting to murder the FBI agent who arrested him, as well as a federal witness in his case. Now, bear in mind, he's now the Attorney General of the United States, and he was supporting somebody who was plotting to murder an FBI agent and a federal witness. This is a very creative approach to law enforcement, I think, and once again indicative of the profound differences between the Democrats and the Republicans. I believe that the death of Mel Carnahan was in all likelihood not an accident and was yet another element of the electoral coup of the year 2000 and another element of what is basically a military gambit. It was not the only act of violence that I believe took place during the campaign. There was a major bombing. Now, bear in mind, in 1980, when the oil price increase helped to destabilize Jimmy Carter, as I've indicated, when the hostage crisis presented rabid fundamentalist Muslims humiliating the United States while the price of oil was going up. Well, once again, in the year 2000, the price of oil soared, and once again, militant Islamic fundamentalists were causing destruction against agents of the American government, and this was seen as humiliating American honor, humiliating American arms, and indicating that, in fact, the Clinton administration was weak, that it really was not in a position to wield the decisive hammer of national security. It turned out in 1980 that the wild-eyed Islamic militants were in fact in bed with the Bush camp and Reagan camp all along. And with regard to the bombing of the destroyer USS Cole, allegedly by Osama bin Laden, I think there are also some indications that wild-eyed Islamic fundamentalists, these militant Muslims, are in fact working for the very people who are pointing the finger at Bill Clinton. Because it turns out that part of the startup capital that helped to fund Arbusto Energy, George W. Bush's first oil company, came from a fellow named James R. Bath, who by his own account, as relayed in the book The Outlaw Bank by Jonathan Beatty and S.C. Gwynne, James R. Bath, by his own account, had been recruited into the CIA by George I, the elder George Bush, and had also been deeply involved with BCCI, which was one of the main institutions used for the Iran-Contra machinations. It was used for funding drug smuggling, money laundering, terrorist operations, the arming of Saddam Hussein, the arming of the Iranians, and also the arming of the Contras. James R. Bath, although not directly linked to the BCCI scandal, was or not directly and formally involved with BCCI, James R. Bath was the Texas business representative for, among others, the father of Osama bin Laden. And it appears that since James R. Bath, according to people who knew him at the time, had no capital of his own, it would appear that part of the startup capital for George W. Bush's energy company, Arbusto Energy, came from the father of Osama bin Laden, which is a very, very interesting thing to contemplate, that here you have a U.S. destroyer blown up at the height of the campaign with the oil price shooting up, again, allegedly by wild-eyed Islamic militants. And please, this is, do not misinterpret this as a slur on the Islamic faith, but rather this is how the journalistic portrayal of this took place, and also how the psychological rationalization took place, I believe, in the mind of the American voter, and certainly the one that was intended by the American journalistic community and probably by the Republican Party as well. The bin Laden organization is now being investigated in connection with the bombing of the Cole. 17 U.S. sailors died, and this helped to reinforce the perception, and the Bush camp was working very hard to reinforce this perception, that Al Gore was weak because Bill Clinton was weak because they couldn't effectively wield not only the hammer of U.S. national security, but that they could not effectively wield the other machinery or could not control the other elements of the machinery of the American government. With the connections between James R. Bath and allegedly the CIA run by George Bush, the same CIA that had issued the phony oil crisis report that spurred the gas price increase in 1979, and which dovetailed with the hostage crisis to present to Americans rising gas prices, an oil shortage, economic privation, and wild-eyed Islamic militants threatening and staining American honor. We were presented with exactly the same thing in the year 2000, or something very similar. And yet, when one examines what was going on, in fact, it turns out that these wild-eyed Islamic militants have very strong connections to not only elements of U.S. intelligence, if one examines the history of Osama bin Laden, but also to the oil industry. Bear in mind that the Osama bin Laden comes from a very wealthy Saudi family, Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil exporter, inextricably linked with the U.S. petroleum industry. Osama bin Laden got his start as a guerrilla fighter working on behalf of the Afghan Mujahideen that were being run by U.S. intelligence, and again with the assistance of George Bush. And it appears that the father of Osama bin Laden put forth a nice chunk of the capital, which in all likelihood went to fund Arbusto Energy, George W. Bush's first oil company. So once again in the year 2000, the price of gas goes up. Wild-eyed Islamic terrorists begin staining American honor and impugning the integrity and power of the American eagle. And once again, it works to the detriment of the Democrats. I think that the things that we've talked about so far, the behavior of the media, the functioning of the death of JFK Jr., the rise in petroleum prices, the Wen Ho Lee case, the Ralph Nader candidacy, whether or not it was intended by, say, the Republicans and the CIA, and that's something that I hold open. It's not a statement I'm making, but it's a question I'm asking. Not only the Wen Ho Lee case, but also the bombing of the USS Cole, the death of Mel Carnahan. All of these things serve to outflank the Gore campaign. They serve to weaken the Democrats from a political standpoint and to weaken them in a military, along the lines of a military paradigm that I've been suggesting. And this basically placed the decision for the electoral coup of 2000 in the state of Florida. These things that I've enumerated so far and that I hope I have at least to a certain extent explained satisfactorily. If not, I'm very sorry because, boy, this is a taxing lecture so far and is not yet over. But I hope that I've enumerated the way in which a number of different factors were utilized to weaken the Democrats fundamentally, and again along the lines of a military paradigm, along the lines of a flanking attack or a pincers movement, and not only the weakening of the Democrats as a political force, but the weakening of the will of the political will of the Democratic Party, and the manipulation of the media and the public's perception in such a way as to make make the Democrats weak and to make the election close. Because by all rights, with the economy being healthy and with Clinton being very popular in spite of the destabilization of his administration, Al Gore should have won handily, and yet he didn't. The election was very, very close. And ultimately it was decided in Florida, a state with 25 electoral votes and a state that was governed by Jeb Bush, George Bush's brother, and a man with very, very strong links to the anti-Castro Cuban community, to elements of organized crime, to the savings and loan scandal, the looting of the Broward savings and loan, and to people like Armando Codina and others. Basically, Jeb Bush had served to a certain extent as the liaison between his father and the anti-Castro Cuban community that was deeply involved with the Contra support effort during the Contra war in Nicaragua. Gore initially was called as being the winner in Florida. However, the media were led, and there have now been studies analyzing this, the media were led in their reversal of Florida from Gore to Bush by a fellow named John Ellis. John Ellis was the head of the political desk at Fox News. He had been one of the most rabid attackers of Bill Clinton during the Monica Lewinsky affair. John Ellis was also, not incidentally, the cousin of George W. and Jeb Bush and the son of the elder George Bush's sister. He was basically family, and he was in regular telephonic communication with both Jeb and George Bush throughout the course of the evening. It was John Ellis who made the call switching Florida from Al Gore to George Bush. This led the media stampede to switch the call on the Florida election. The journal, American journalists have sometimes been compared to blackbirds. When one alights on a wire, they all land, and when one flies away, they all fly away. It was John Ellis who led the flock to alight on the Bush wire rather than the Gore wire on election night. And that perception, relayed by the media and led by John Ellis, was what basically led a lot of Americans to think that Al Gore was being a spoil sport or a sore loser, that Bush had actually won, and that Al Gore was simply suffering from a case of distemper. In fact, that was not the case. But it's very important to understand the role of John Ellis and the Fox News desk in leading the media charge to reverse Florida from Gore to Bush, because that had a lot to do with not only the public's perception, but also the Democrats' perception of what the public was perceiving. It had a lot to do with it. As many people now know, there were a lot of electoral shenanigans in Florida, and there was a great deal of reason for the Gore campaign to be suspicious of what took place in Florida. First of all, the famous Palm Beach butterfly ballots, in which the place next to the ballot, in which the name of Al Gore was not placed in the position that it was required to be placed in by Florida law. Absentee ballots were illegally manipulated in Florida. Two Republican operatives were allowed to spend 10 days inside a local Republican Party headquarters illegally completing absentee ballot forms in violation of Florida electoral law. Large numbers of African American voters in Florida were illegally and wrongly classified as convicted felons and their votes thereby disqualified. The company that was involved with this classification had strong links to political machinery of Jeb Bush. There also was documented harassment of African Americans on the way to the polls. Florida state troopers stopped African Americans when they were on their way to the polls, harassed them, and basically discouraged them from casting their votes. And 91% of the African American vote went for Al Gore during the course of election 2000. There was the issue of the hanging chads. There were dimpled ballots in which it appeared that someone had tried to punch a ballot through for one candidate or another, but had been unsuccessful in doing that. And again, due to the Palm Beach butterfly ballots, there were a number of ballots that had been punched many times. And what I'm going to do is to read an analysis of some of the disqualified votes. And one wants to listen very carefully to the numbers here and bear in mind that a random error would fall roughly along the lines of random probability, roughly 50-50. If people who were too old read, you know, senile old Jewish retirees in Palm Beach, or people who are too careless read those dumb old black folks who just can't figure out anything, if they really were making the mistakes that they were hinted as having made by the media and by the Republicans, those errors would have been would have fallen roughly along the lines of random probability, roughly 50-50.